Tonight, we are going to start a new study on Ecclesiastes, which is a very intriguing book. It's very unlike any other book in the Bible. Probably the closest similarity would be Job in terms of some of the structure, in the sense that Job, you'll recall, has this dialogue with these three friends. And much of what Job says, and almost all what the three friends say, aren't of a lot of value in terms of truth. They make wrong assumptions. They have wrong views for God. Well, in Ecclesiastes, we have that similarity in that the book as a whole has a very positive message, but we have a lot of statements in it that are very difficult for us because of the different style and genre. But they're also very pessimistic. They're not, it's not necessarily statements of truth in the general sense that we think of truth. The opening verse refers to the preacher or teacher, depending on your translation. The term appears in the first verse and the second verse, verse 12. And then we don't find this term again until the middle of the book, in 7:27 it's referred to. And then it reappears at the very end. Traditionally, this title has been understood to refer to Solomon. However, there are many conservative scholars who believe that the preacher, teacher, is someone other than Solomon. It's kind of an interesting term, as sometimes translations do. They come along and they get transliterated into other languages. Transliteration is where you basically take the letters and make it the appropriate letter in the other language as opposed to giving a translation. And so we really get the term Ecclesiastes from the Latin. But our translation, Ecclesiastes, is basically the same word that is thus translated in the passage as preacher. You know, those are the same kind of terms. And you kind of see where some of these come from. If it's those that, not our modern translations, but if you go back earlier, those that argued for the idea of preacher, then they saw this as someone that was speaking to a religious group. And thus it was, the idea of preacher. Those that saw this more in a secular setting, then they opted for the idea of teacher. Now that argument wouldn't necessarily be true in our modern translation, as they're just trying to use these terms. But as far as what the term actually means, the Hebrew scholars just say they're not sure. It's not a term that we find in such a way that we can give clear definition to it. Though in this context, it's not a term that has to have clear meaning, because it clearly is referring to someone. It's more in the sense of a title. While the preacher is identified, in verse 1, as the son of David, also a king in Jerusalem in verse 1, and then king over Israel in Jerusalem in verse 12, there are other passages that raise questions as to whether or not this could truly be Solomon. We'll look at these later on, but there's some passages that where it's making reference that there's not justice in the land, and lamenting the fact that, there's nobody in control. Well, if Solomon was writing that, then why wouldn't he be in control? Why wouldn't he bring about justice if that's something important to him? Conservative scholars are divided as to whether the book has one or two writers, actually. So those that see it as one writer, then they would typically see this as a book that's penned by Solomon. However, there's another thought that there are actually two writers. The vast majority of the book is by the one that's identified here as preacher. And basically the book is a long quotation by this person. But yet it's framed at the beginning and at the end by a narrator. And it's the narrator who brings all the wealth of the theology to it. The big long quote, the majority of the text, is really somebody that's pretty skeptical, but it's placed in such a context by the narrator that it gives it this overall meaning. The bottom line is you end up with basically the same thing, obviously vastly different views, but you end up somewhat with the same message, that the message of Ecclesiastes as a whole, I mean, if you were to just say, you know, the bulk of the material, it's pessimistic. The message of Ecclesiastes as a whole, however, is very optimistic, because it you know, you have to see it in that whole sense, not just looking at one concept, because it's pointing to something. The theme there, as we move on to thinking about the theme or the purpose of it, there's not a lot of doubt about it, not our argumentation in that regard. It's because it tells us at the beginning and at the end. In verse 2, it tells us, "Vanity of vanities," says the preacher. "Vanity of vanities, all is vanity." If you look at the very end of it, in verse 8, comes back and says, "Vanity of vanity," says the preacher. "All is vanity." So their overall message in that regard, the theme, if you would, not the message, but the theme is that all is vanity. This idea that all is vanity, or the NIV says all is meaningless, and this is, you know, throughout the book would include the idea of work, wisdom, righteousness, wealth, prestige, pleasure, youth, life, and even any sense of a future life. The Hebrew word here that's translated vanity, or if you have NIV, meaningless, refers to that sense of a breath. You know, it's a wind, you know, just this sense of a vapor. And you can think of, in that regard, of breathing out, perhaps, if since you don't normally can, you know, can have an indication of your breath. But if it's a cold morning and the temperature and the humidity is just right, and you breathe out and you see this little bit of vapor, and it lasts just, you know, long enough for you to kind of get a glimpse of it, or perhaps more if it's somebody else. You may not even be able to see your own. But it's that sense of that it just dissipates. It's just gone. And that would be this idea that it's just vanity. It's meaningless. It just whiffs away. It's used elsewhere, you know, the same thing, like chasing after the wind. There's no advantage, nothing gained. So it's basically saying, you know, in its essence, in its figurative sense, is saying it's, you know, there's nothing substantial about it. It's has no real value. The preacher passes his verdict on man's toil as having no lasting value. That work has no lasting value. And when you think of, you know, when you hear that at first, then our immediate thought is, well, that's not true. I mean, work has value. I mean, even if you don't see philosophical value, you say, well, it has value because there's a paycheck. There's, you know, we see value in it. But if you think of it in terms of long term, what's the value? And we try to come up with things. Well, you know, somebody did this and it carried on this, but how did it profit them? And is that regard, if no matter how much money you make, when it's all said and done, somebody else gets the money. You know, and so we have these people nowadays that, you know, leave their money to a cat or something. And, you know, maybe that's their frustration because it. But it's likewise the view here is also the same about wisdom and righteousness. They're deficits. They don't provide any absolute guarantees. So it's that looking at life and saying, well, you know, I mean, yeah, some people have wisdom and it profits them. Or somebody else has got wisdom and in this. And, you know, we could come up with the same observations in a, you know, you can, there was something, I saw a reference to a new study in a medical journal that was, there were four things, I can't remember what the fourth one is, so I better find out because maybe I'm doing it and that's not going to help me. But it was saying that you know, if you don't smoke and if you eat so many, you know, four or five vegetables a day and you exercise and a fourth, whatever, huh? Fruit? Well, no, it was fruit and vegetables was the, yeah, that. But I don't know what, I can't remember what the fourth, I think there was four things, so. Oh, that's it, no, alcohol, moderate consumption of alcohol. So those are the four, so it's moderate consumption of alcohol, don't smoke, eat, you know, the fruits and vegetables daily, and, you know, exercise, then you add 14 years to your life. So you could say, in that sense of a proverb, of what's generally true. And then you come to somebody like, who was it a long time ago? George Burns, that was always on TV with his cigar. Lived to be, what, 135 or something? And, you know, or somebody else that, you know, does all these things, and, you know, while they're exercising, they get run over by a bus. You know, you can look at those things and become very pessimistic. Because you say, there is no guarantee. You may tell me that generally this is true, but there's no guarantee. And that seems to be very much of what we find here. But the purpose of this pessimistic material is to demonstrate empirically to us that in all the insecurity of human effort, you know, it doesn't provide any real meaning. Human effort does not provide real meaning. However, significance, you know, under the sun, you know, that sense of looking for something, drives one to God. Because there's no real meaning in life in and of, you know, just life. Because when you, if you start to probe that, then it's like, oh, I'm going to acquire all of these things, and at best, I'm going to leave them to somebody I love. But then, how's that going to impact their life? What, are they going to misuse it? At worst, it's going to be taken by somebody that I don't even know. And so, but if you look at all that and you say, well, then there's meaning to life, but it's not found in these things. And so vanity of vanity, all is vanity, is in that sense of life under the sun, life apart from God. So the end result is that there's a message here that all human endeavors lack ultimate value. Therefore, life should be enjoyed in the fear of the Lord and viewed as a gift from His hand. The book directs us to a responsive reverence and fear of God. There's three directives that we will, you know, maybe could discern for all, as we go through it. But one is this response to God, that, you know, of reverence and fear because He is the Lord. Secondly, it's a response to obedience to the commands of God. And third, it directs us to a responsive life in the present in light of the future. The structure, and, you know, if you have a study Bible, you know, your outline may be one way and somebody another one another way, which is always the case with books like this. But one way to see this and how we'll follow it is to see that the vast majority, kind of this middle section, if you would, but it's the vast majority, divides into two parts. And so from verse 12 through about the middle of the book and verse 6-9, you know, is one section. And then the second half of that picks up at 6-10 and goes toward the end. And goes to, you know, 12, about 7. And then on both sides of that is this opening and this closing that frames this. And so this prelude and this almost epilogue at the end. As you look through, or as we look through this, we're going to come across a lot of terms. And one of the great things, if you want to, you know, read Ecclesiastes, is to... you know, have some colored pencils, and because you have so many reoccurring words, and so you can read it through one time, just looking for these words and highlight them. And there are so many of them that stand out. But one is this term "under the sun." In 1:3, it says, "What advantage does man have in all his work, which he does under the sun?" So you have a lot of questions in this book. In 1:9. That which has been is that which will be, and that which has been done is that which will be done, so there is nothing new under the sun. That doesn't, you know, in an age when things are invented and discovered all the time, you kind of go, well, that can't be true. But in one sense, and as you know, we'll see, there are these sense of categories, and nothing really changes out of those. 2:11, Thus I considered all my activities which my hand had done, and the labor which I had exerted, and behold, all was vanity in striving after the wind, and there was no profit under the sun. 2:17. So I hated life, for the work which had been done under the sun was grievous to me, because everything is futile in striving after wind. 2:18. Thus I hated all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun, for I must leave it to the man who will come after me. So see, that's that idea of I've done all this work, but somebody else is going to benefit from it. What is it? Yeah, look at that one. And who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool? Yet he will have control over the fruit of my labor for which I have labored by acting wisely under the sun. This too is vanity. Right here, there's a lot of it because it picks up again in 2:20. Therefore, I completely despaired of all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun. 2:22. For what does a man get in all his labor and in his striving which he labors under the sun? 3:16. Furthermore, I have seen under the sun that in the place of justice there is wickedness, and in the place of righteousness there is wickedness. 4:1. Then I looked again at all the acts of oppression which were being done under the sun. And behold, I saw the tears of the oppressed, and that they had no one to comfort them, and on the side of their oppressors was power, but they had no one to comfort them. Well, it just continues. I mean, you can go on for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16 more under the suns, you know. The other one is vanity. We already saw that it begins with vanity of vanities. 1:14 says, I have seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after the wind. Several of those in the 2:19, 2:20 had the same vanity. 2:23, because all his days his task is painful and grievous. Even at night his mind does not rest. This too is vanity. 2:26. For to a person who is good in his sight, he has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, while to the sinner he has given the task of gathering and collecting, so that he may give to one who is good in God's sight. This too is vanity and striving after the wind. 4:4. I have seen that every labor and every skill which is done is the result of rivalry between a man and his neighbor. This too is vanity and striving after the wind. Kind of interesting, you know, this idea that all labor, everything that's produced is because somebody's trying to outdo somebody else. Somebody's trying to show somebody else up. Somebody's trying to accomplish something before somebody else. And you know, a lot of that is true. My understanding of, you know, with that there was, and maybe Rob's a historian, maybe he'll know this. When Darwin published his book, he published it before he wanted to publish it because there was another person that was going to publish, and nobody knows that person's name because Darwin published his first. You know, so there is that sense of those kinds of things that do go on. Vanity. How do we use? What is vanity in reference to?
I think of it as pride. Pride. Or,
I'm
over.
Sorry. What? Silver sink.
She's gonna get
yeah.
Out.
Yeah.
So when I think of it as pride, mm-hmm. over inflated ego, but meaningless.
But it'd be
completely different meaning.
True, but if you go back to the odd, you know, we're saying where does the word come from? You know, it was from that sense of breath, and so if you go the vanity the other way, it becomes that sense of puffed up. So that's what I would assume is where that sense comes from. And so the sense of saying somebody is so vain, you know, they have that puffed up sense about them, pride about them that's not based on. So somebody that actually, you know, next year it could be totally different, but this year in football, if Tom Brady wants to be arrogant, nobody's going to say he's vain. Now, they may say he's vain about it in some other regard, but not about his, you know, what he's done on the football field, because he set records this year. So you wouldn't say that about him, but then you go to somebody else that's, you know, trying to carry that on. So I think those would be the connection, not in the sense of meaningless, you know, across the board, but that would be the connection. Now, as far as what the dictionary definition is, I was not positive on that, but that would be the connection here, that sense of breath. Yeah. And which would be the same idea as, you know, meaningless. Yeah. Well, and then those will be the reasons you'll like the NIV, because it uses terminology that is more in the colloquial language, which has advantages and disadvantages. Then there's this striving after the wind, which then this wind is the same kind of a concept here. In 1:14, I have seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after wind. So there we see all three of these kind of put together. 1:17, I set my mind to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I realized that this also is striving after the wind. So this striving after the wind is that same thing. You cannot ever grasp it. You can just not grasp it. I may have mentioned before when I was in college, this little boy lived in this one time when we lived in this house. Some guys, friends of mine, we in this house in the neighborhood, and so there's a little boy lived next door. And I guess, you know, today's term, he'd be mentally challenged. And you know, and this is outside of Amarillo Canyon's on the other side of Amarillo, and so it's in the panhandle where the wind blows all the time. But he was fed up with the wind that day. And we asked him, you know, he was on his bicycle and had his BB gun. He said, you know, what are you doing? He said, I'm going to the edge of the town to shoot the wind. And he was tired of the wind. But that's, you know, we'd all love to get to that place where the wind starts and, you know, put a wall up or do something. But where is that place? You know, there's just that sense of striving after the wind. Is that, you know, you cannot... cannot accomplish, cannot reach it. And you see the futility here, just in those terms of, you know, striving after the wind. 4:4, I have seen that every labor and every skill which is done is, we already read that one, is a result of rivalry. You know, that's striving after. And so 6:9, what the eye see is better than what the soul desires. You know, that's pretty pessimistic. You know, what the eye sees is better than what the soul desires. So you can see there's some statements in here by themselves. You'd go, how did that get in the Bible? Because it doesn't fit the sense of grandioso truth. It doesn't fit with the sense of, you know, an awesome God. But what it does fit is looking at life and trying to make sense out of life when there is no God, when there is no real purpose. And it makes you wonder, I mean, you know, where... See, people don't really ponder this. Because if you ponder life without God, then it doesn't give you anything. You know, the only thing it really gives you is that sense of the beer commercial that, you know, get all you, whatever it is, get all you can or do all you can or whatever, because all the gusto you can because you only go around once or something. I mean, that really is the concept of Ecclesiastes. And that would be consistent with life in an evolutionary form. When this life is over, that's it. Whatever you accomplished, whatever you enjoyed out of life, that's it. And so people come up with other things, a sense of reincarnation. You know, people come up with things. Listen to Ravi Zacharias. It's probably an older tape, but he was saying that, you know, this would be relative, you know, time-wise, but not necessarily last week, but it could have been a year or two ago, but there was a Lutheran pastor that spoke to a science group in Washington, or maybe not a pastor, but a Lutheran teacher. I mean, it may have been a seminary. And was saying that we need to come up with a more plausible God, something that we can, you know, sell out to, that we can believe in, because, you know, the Orthodox God has just gotten too ridiculous. There's nothing you can really believe there. You know, science made too many advances. It doesn't. And he didn't really have anybody to offer. He said, you know, let the artist and the movie makers and the authors, you know, let them come up with a God. But we need somebody that we can, you know, this new image that you can believe in, that you can put hope in. And, you know, while that sounds so ridiculous when you hear it that way, that's in essence what people do. Because if not, you would be left with this, that all is vanity. But if you look at everything and say, oh, it's vanity, it drives you somewhere. And so for some, it drives them to make up a religion. But the other thing that we would hope it does is it puts us in that position of saying there is a God and recognizing that God and moving toward Him. He also has these statements about labor, and there's quite a few about labor, or toil, depending on your translation. In 2:10... He says, all that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart was pleased because of all my labor, and this was my reward for all my labor. Chapter 2 has quite a bit. 2:24, there is nothing better for a man than to eat, drink, and tell himself that his labor is good. 4:6, one hand full of rest is better than two fists full of labor and striving after the wind. And so most of the ones on labor are in the first half of the book, however. But, you know, as we get in the next few weeks and look in Ecclesiastes, it will be that book that has that challenge to it, because as you look at certain statements, that you'd say, well, I don't believe that. That doesn't, you know, that's not my view of life. I don't think that's what the Bible is saying. And we have to see it in the sense of almost the whole message. And I think, like I mentioned at the very beginning, I think the only other book that we'd really make that kind of an equation with would be Job. And Job is this extremely long book to read. And you have these long, long speeches. And the speeches are, wrong. The viewpoint is wrong. But what it does, it puts you in that position that when you get to the end of Job and God speaks, that there's this total different setting, different perspective. And just to read the end of Job, which is very beneficial because you have this, you know, just such a high view of God's sovereignty, is somehow to miss the futility that leads up to that. And so if you're with Job and you go through all of that, where he comes to the end having argued with these, you know, stupid friends of his that, hey, I didn't do anything wrong. And then he moves to the position, hey, I'm really a righteous guy, righteous person. God, what are you doing? You really don't have any right to be doing this. And God says, right, I'm God. Who are you? Where were you? So this book is similar in that regard. Any thoughts or questions? Or
so is under the sun just a colloquialism for meaning life?
I think so. I think we it's looking at life here on Earth, and that's where most of this is. So it's kind of that physical life on Earth, I think, is what we'll see. I don't know. That's an excellent question, though. I don't know. It's an interesting.
I was going to ask, are you a pessimist or are you an
optimist? I'm an optimist. The range of pessimism is really, when he does that, I want to be Job, so I can just say, of course, I'm not.
Well, I mean, Martin Luther's wife came out one day, and Martin Luther evidently always struggled with depression and are off and on, and she came out one day dressed in black, and he said, you know, what's going on? You know, what funeral are you going to? She said, oh, didn't you hear? God died. So, kind of got his attention, you know. So, yeah, sometimes that's not bad. No, I don't know. I don't know. I wouldn't even know how to.
It was just like, you know, y'all with Chesterton had those two that y'all were looking at, which is the first time that made me think that Randy might have some valid point in me. So when I'm looking at this,
I was pessimistic the whole time I was reading Chesterton.
So I just was curious about the validity of it because he's taking a pessimist stance.
Right. Basically it is, except the beginning and ending. No, I mean, it's not like there's not other, you know, statements in it that aren't of you know, that we might have a... It's not like everything is just...
I mean, I would say that...
But it's pessimistic in the sense that there is no value in life. That's this, you know, the almost the entire book, that's basically what it says.
Everything I've done of myself...
Yeah. But, you know, so, but as far as how to, you know, those, you know, what interpreters or commentators over the years were, you know, I wouldn't even know how to approach that. That's an interesting thought, though. I think I think you're left with it that you really have to try to say that this book is optimistic. I mean, talking not the whole message, because the message of the book is very optimistic. We're talking about the parts of it to say it's optimistic. You have to reinvent it. You have to read into it. You have to put things that aren't there. And, you know, sometimes people try to do that because they don't want to deal
with them. So what is the optimistic message of it? What's the value of it other than it's God's
word? Well, I mean, the value is that if you look at life on this plane and you focus on life here and you focus on the details of life, that life has no meaning. And the value of that is if it pushes you somewhere. If it pushes you somewhere. So, you know, if it leaves you in despair, then it had no life. If you reject God, then it has no value. But that'd be like the gospel. You could say, what's the value of the gospel? The gospel is about that somebody died. And, you know, if you reject the gospel, then it has no value. Paul says that, you know, the same message to those that are alive is this fragrant aroma, and those that are rejecting it, you know, it's just something that doesn't smell good. It's an aroma to both, but it's for one, it's one kind of aroma, to the other, it's another kind of aroma. So I think that's, you know, overall, that's what you're going to see in this book, it challenges, you know, life and how we view life. And where do we put our meaning? So in the sense of meaning, in the sense of purpose, and we're not immune to that. Where do we find value in life? And so we find value in life out of, you know, my job. I found value in life out of my family. I find value in life out of, you know, how much I've accumulated. I find value in life out of, and we fill in those blanks. And when we do that, and when we're saying, you know, I'm not saying those things don't have meaning, not saying those things don't have some value. When we say that's the value that I find, though, that's what I live for, then we're doing exactly this. And we're not thinking any deeper about life than the unbeliever that cannot think deeper about it because it would drive you to despair. So for the believer, you know, as we think about these things, then it would reorient us to this sense of that life's value is in God. And so where's, you know, where do I find it? Because you think about all the things that if you put value in, which we tend to do in various things, what happens when they go wrong? What happens to your value? So I think those are, you know, in essence, in the real brief sense that that would be the overall value we'll see. Well, are there things that we can pray about this evening?